Sure, spread them with me.
So, I will share it with those of you who are here, and then I'll reiterate it when those who usually come late show up. I did get the exams done. A couple of you did not take it. I don't know if the people who didn't take it are not here. And I also was faced with the deadline that I needed to submit my midterm grades yesterday. I just got them done during my break. So what ended up happening this time around is, if you didn't take exam number two for midterm grades, that counted as a zero. I'm going to let you do it as a makeup. That's fine. You just got to get it done. But it just wasn't there in place when I took the exam. The other thing is that I, using my AI detectors that I have access to, was going through everyone's essays, and I found six or seven students that came up 100% AI written. So as it states on the syllabus, this is not a class where AI is allowed. So if you are one of those students that I suspect use AI, essentially cheating, your grade is a 60. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to, if you claim that you did not cheat, I will allow you to take a physical exam, a paper exam. And we can do that on Thursday to give you a chance to study a little more. But if you recognize the fact that I caught you cheating and you're going to learn your lesson and we're going to move forward through the rest of the semester without there being any issues, then your grade was not necessarily impacted because I decided not to go back and re-scan the first exam. So in other words, what I'm trying to say is I'm giving you the benefit of the doubt. But if you are one of those people that got a 60 on exam number two, and you should be able to see your exams. And like I said, if you don't think you actually cheated, send me an email and we'll make it good. But your midterm grade has that added in. So I don't know how quickly the college processes the midterm grades. I don't know if you can access your midterm grade immediately, but it should be there in the system. Ultimately, just to remind you, as I did say at the beginning of the semester, and it does state on the syllabus, no AI. Now, I let you do the at-home exams, assuming that you take good notes, and I want to make this class as easy as possible for you. But again, when I see students get through the exam in like 15 minutes and they get everything right, you know, it's kind of a red flag. It's kind of obvious. So let's learn from this. Let's move forward. And again, like I said, if you have issue, send me an email and we can talk about it. Yes. Oh, sorry. I think I was going on.
No, just putting up the hand.
All right. So that being said, we've gotten through the first two exams, which means we're at the halfway point. But your first two exams only count as 30% of your final grade. So that means we still have exam number three, which is 15%, your final, which is 35%, and your paper, that is 20%. So we're going to go easy this week. We're going to start the stuff for exam three. We're not going to be here next week because it's spring break. And then when we come back, we're going to have to put it in high gear because we got lots to get done. My advice is if you don't have any plans over spring break, that's a good time to bang out your paper because I think you can still get extra credit for submitting your paper, getting it in early. So take advantage of the fact that we're not going to be here so you can get that off your plate. Because again, the last thing you want to do is submit a bad paper because the paper counts as 20% of your grade. And yes, as should be obvious, I will be scanning your papers as well to make sure that there's no shenanigans going on. College isn't necessarily about remembering every last detail that you learn in class, but college is about getting skills to be successful in life. And if you master those skills, the world is your oyster. Hard work, honesty. The best two keys of life. At least my humble opinion. All right. One other thing I should say is our exams are not cumulative. So, line in your notebooks, you start going forward. We dealt with the age of exploration. We know why the age of exploration occurred. We know that the Europeans fanned out and basically began coming in contact with global civilizations. In Central and South America, it was conquered. Throughout the Asian region, there was the Europeans entering it. But as we saw, there were ancient, powerful civilizations there. So what happened in Central and South America did not happen in Asia. But by the 18th century, 1700s, going into the 19th century, the 1800s, things began to change because the Europeans slowly started acquiring wealth. They slowly started impacting local politics, which would eventually allow them to start taking control. Now, the 18th century and into the 19th century was a wonderful time, because what the Europeans were doing is they were taking advantage of the wealth that they were getting and obtaining knowledge, learning more about the world. And if you've taken Western Civ 2, you learned about the scientific revolution, the industrial revolution, all of those things that were occurring as a byproduct of this age of exploration. These developments would continue to give rise to what sociologists refer to as isms, ideological movements, if you will. And some of these isms were linked directly to this economic expansion. Of course, the Industrial Revolution would have a huge impact, because not only was there money to make, but you needed tons and tons of resources to fuel these factory systems, to maintain high levels of productivity. But it also allowed for goods to be produced quicker, faster, cheaper. So simultaneously, you needed places to sell this stuff. And they learned more about the process. People started studying. And new schools of science were developing. Because technology allowed for progress faster than it had ever been. For example, by the 1850s, 60s, 70s, it was possible to electronically communicate with somebody 10 states away. The development of the telegraph, the which would give rise to the telephone. But that spearheaded the need to communicate longer distances faster. So they started developing transatlantic underwater cables to link the continents. So by 1900, it literally was possible for something to happen anywhere on Earth, and within hours, word would spread. Of course, not like today, where it could be instantaneously, because of satellite technology. But back then, it could take months for word to spread. Infrastructure also boomed, because you have to move more resources, more commodities. Thanks to the advent of the railroad, it made it possible to move more goods further inland than just with a horse and a cart. Progress, innovation after innovation. Which led to more learning. Half of the curriculum that you take here at the college. All of these scientific areas, they were all developed in the 19th century. Thermodynamics. You know, the study of how metal interacts with heat. Well, that's necessarily school, because if you're using these massive factory machines and you overwork them, they could break. Could lead to death. Many books have been written on the Industrial Revolution, as well as the many industrial accidents that occurred during it. Electromagnetism was invented, which is when they started messing with not only electricity, but also magnets. That's the basis of our EVs. It's how electronic vehicles travel. It's how they get their power. In other areas, sterilizing milk, for example, Louis Pasteur, which meant that you were learning how to better store food, keep food longer periods of time, which meant you could feed more mouths. And the Europeans didn't keep it to themselves. Again, spreading global. Why? Well, the old hand-done printing press was modified and added a steam engine, which means that you could suddenly pump out books in minutes. Any of you, I don't even know if they still make printer papers at the Telegram and Gazette, but I remember when I was a kid, we took a field trip. Did you go?
I don't remember.
But there was the building down in downtown Worcester. We went down to the basement and this massive printing press, and you could see them make like thousands of newspapers in seconds. So the ideas would be put in print, the books would be mass produced and sold globally. And universities changed their curriculum as well. No more classical learning, where you learned like rhetoric. Instead, you started having the appearance of liberal arts educations. Well, all of these developments inspired people to continue to learn, to think, to research. But a few of them would be game-changing. Of all of the isms to develop during this period of change, one of them would come out of nowhere and would transform the way that the Europeans viewed the world. Darwinism. Charles Darwin would, after going on some journeys, seeing remote places on the earth, would develop a revolutionary theory, which he called evolution. In his book on the origins of species, by means of natural selection, he hypothesized that all life on Earth have evolved from more primitive ancestors. Now, by the way, it could be argued that Darwin's book was one of the most influential books in human civilization, because what it did was directly contradict the biblical stories of creation, which are entrenched in every civilization on earth, that some higher power created mankind. This is critical, because out of this, if Darwin is right, that means, unlike, say, the creation in the book of Genesis, in which it is claimed that God made man and woman in his own image, thus everyone is the same, to the potential of no. Human beings have evolved, and that evolution has left people different. Now, Darwin bases his theories on three key arguments. And I'm sure you've learned these. At least I assume you did. The first is that all organisms on Earth are constantly struggling to exist. So, in this struggle, this means competition. Everything's competing for food. Everything's competing for shelter. And, FYI, everyone is competing for the ability to reproduce. Because if you can't reproduce, what happens to your species? You're out of business. You're done. Now, here's the thing. Because all organisms are not equal, this means some are going to win. But that also means some are going to lose. Those species who cannot get the food, cannot get the shelter, cannot adequately reproduce, will go extinct. But those who can get food, get shelter, reproduce, they will survive. Okay, that's common sense, I think. But here's where Darwin goes a little bit out there. What he says is the characteristics of a species that allow them to be successful will continue to evolve with each successive generation. So, if a human being was faster and could outwit a lion, in theory, that means that the next offspring, or maybe the next offspring, will be a little faster, a little more clever. Because if they lack those skills, they would get eaten and cease to be. By the way, does anyone know what our biological advantage is over every other species on Earth that has ever lived? What about that?
We can grab things and build things.
So it's not this. We have the ability to do this. This is it. This is the key to our evolutionary success. Your thumb can touch your pinky. Because your thumb can touch the pinky, that means you can... not. Because monkeys, don't forget, chimpanzees, they can hold things, but they don't really grasp them that hard. We can wrap our hand around it and get a tight, firm grip. Well, Darwin argues every single species that exists today had something that allowed them to be better than their competitors. And it's this struggle that basically triggers evolution. So, you have these generational shifts, you have this evolution, but it's not any one species that determines winner or losers. No, it's nature. Nature determines the species that will survive. Because if you have the right traits and you can get food, you can get shelter, then you're going to be able to allow to continue to expand your populations. But if you have inferior traits, Mother Nature, she's a cruel mistress. She will wipe you out. So what does this mean? Well, there are winners, there are losers. There are stronger and weaker divisions in nature. But what should the strong be allowed to do if they are indeed the most fit? But at what cost?
The cost of the weaker.
To what extent?
For animals, you know, they'll eat each other. for humans, it'll be more so the stronger has dominion over the weaker.
Well done. Darwinism had a tremendous impact on thinkers beginning in the 1850s, 1860s, 1870s. They took Darwin's ideas and they tried applying it everywhere, including societies. Darwinism would give rise to an offshoot known as social Darwinism, in which Darwin's theories are applied to the social sciences, to human relations. And as Jordan said, winners and losers. The winners should be able to exploit the losers. Thinkers, the late 19th century, started saying, hey, look, okay, human beings, fine. We're all kind of like the same to a degree. We all have heads. We have two eyes, nose, mouth, 10, two arms, two legs. Cut us, we'll bleed, yada, 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 yada. But there are certain peoples that live in advanced societies with industrialized economies that have the ability to impact situations globally. And then there are some other human beings that are still living in rainforests somewhere, running around half naked, and their technological advancement is they can use a stone and sharpen a stick. Well, what's the difference? Well, the industrialized society must be the stronger society. They must have those traits within their culture that allow them to outcompete all the competition. Because if they weren't better, they wouldn't be so powerful. Now, initially, Darwinism focused on economics, and it became the language of the robber barons and the corporate capitalists. You know, why should J.P. Morgan or any of the other big wealthy robber barons, why should they have a Rockefeller? You know, did you know Standard Oil at one point produced all, something like 90% of the world's oil products? You know, what allowed him to have that much power, wealth, and control? Well, he ran his business better than everybody else. And he put everyone else out of business. Well, if they're so good, then they should be allowed to make megabucks. And by the way, any of you ever gone down to Newport? Down by the breakers and see all those mansions? Those were the summer cottages of these people. That's how much they had more wealth than nations. And that was okay. That was okay. Because during the 19th century, most people embraced classical liberalism. And of course, laissez-faire economics. The notion that the government should not be involved in regulating the economy, because that would be an interference with personal freedom. Because at the end of the day, does the government know what's best for you? No, you do. So you should be allowed to do whatever you need to do to be successful. No one should stand in your way. Because if you're able to rise from rags to riches, you did that all on your own. But the problem with that is the other side. In justifying capitalistic success and the amassing of more wealth than countries, people started, let's put it another way than I have it up here, let's say being less than empathetic. So if you go back and you read the books, and by the way, I've been teaching for a long time, and I actually have some elementary school books you know, that were published in the 1870s and 80s. And I'll tell you, the stuff that those kids used to know, some of the things that the kids in like 5, 6, 7th grade used to know, I have a hard time understanding. Used to push kids back then. But one of the things that they were taught was simple values of success. Hard work. You do whatever it takes to be successful. That you are thrifty. You know, you don't waste your money on foolish things like $9 for a mocha latte cappuccino with froth at Starbucks. And you don't ask anyone for help. You engage in self-help. You do it yourself. Well, those are the attitudes that they believe led to success. But what about those who were not successful? Well, they used labels, like that they were lazy, that they were wasteful, that they were stupid, that they were relying upon others. So one set of values led to success, and another set of values led to failure. Wait, what am I saying? That there are winners and there are losers. Yes.
In different civilizations or countries, let's start with countries, were citizens like, you can't do that because we rule you, like a communism or...
Oh, okay.
And how...
Here was the exact opposite, though.
How is where we're at, having our choices, different than the French Revolution, when the very wealthy were so separate that the under people revolted and won?
Well, do you think that we are actually all equal today?
In this country?
Or do we actually have a new, maybe not birthright sense of nobility, but that there is essentially a ruling class that's unattainable by the vast majority of us?
I think in some places it's more prevalent, and some it's not at all. Mm-hmm. In Oklahoma, I don't think there's that. I think New York City, it must be deadly.
Oh, yeah. But again, of course, how do you get to the upper stratospheres in New York City? You know, you had to go to the right college, you had to know the right people, you had to get the right profession.
And worked on Wall Street.
And worked on Wall Street, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
All right, so attitudes started forming. Attitudes. And again, by the way, you go back into the 1700s and the 1600s to what Jane was alluding to, you did have the nobles, which were usually the top 10% of society. And you were born into that society. There was no getting into that society. Which meant the 90%, they considered themselves either commoners or peasants. And life was just that. Life was what it was. But now, in the 19th century, people are saying, no, if you work hard, it doesn't matter what your last name is. You could potentially become a Rockefeller, a Morgan, a Carnegie. But if you don't, well, that's your fault. Just like your success is your fault. So now what about modern attitudes? Like the welfare safety net that we have in place. Well, if you read the works from the 19th century, they would say that is foolish. Why would you redistribute wealth? Why would you take wealth from the people who worked hard and earned it and give it to the people who don't work hard and don't earn it? Survival of the fittest. If a person cannot get enough to eat, do they deserve a meal? And if you read even further into the works of the social Darwinists, you'll see arguments essentially justifying such a death. Because if somebody who can't earn for themselves doesn't get food that's taken from someone else's table, that means the person who earns it will have a bigger meal. greater good, for the greater good of the species. Those who have it should keep it. Those who can take it should take it. And those who can't keep it don't deserve it.
Wow.
Questions before I go on?
How is this playing out now?
I think the pendulum went very, very far. And I think part of what's going on today, not trying to be political, is a reaction to people kind of like lifting the roof off and seeing how far it went, and them asking themselves, I work so hard, I'm barely getting by, the government's taking 60% of every dollar I make, and where are they spending it? I think that's where we're in today.
Okay.
Any other questions? Now, here's the thing. Not everybody had the, well, if they can't hurt themselves, they should die attitude. That's not what I'm saying. It's like any movement. There was a wide spectrum. And again, there were hundreds of writers that were writing books and philosophical papers during this time period. And we don't have time to talk about them all. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you the boundaries to the extent that these social Darwinists were arguing. On one hand, you had what I guess we could say the most, I don't want to say soft, but I don't know, maybe the most compassionate wing of the social Darwinists, typically spearheaded by men like Herbert Spencer. He didn't argue that food should be denied to the poor people. No. Spencer, he was a philosopher. He was an anthropologist. He was a sociologist. He argued that what the fit should do is to help the unfit by going in and evolving those societies. In his work, The Social Studies, which was published in 1850, he basically argues for imperialism. He says it's the duty of the industrialized nations to conquer the backwards nations and to help bring them up. Because if you can take those people that were living in the rainforest half naked using sharp-pointed sticks and bring them into the modern world, they're going to be able to produce commodities that have value. They're going to be able to produce ideas that have value. Which means more opportunity for the people who get them there. So, he is not in any way, shape, or form calling for extermination. Because he says, okay, fine, if there's a cheetah and there's a little guinea pig, and the guinea pig, thanks to nature, is slow and soft and fluffy, but the cheetah is quick and vicious, well, then in nature, the cheetah should eat all the guinea pigs. But that's not what we do as being human beings. No, human beings, we're different. We're more advanced. So instead of trying to wipe out the more primitive civilizations, we should be trying to help the inferiors. Because it will work out in the long run for everybody. So instead of extermination, what Spencer argued was for altruism. Altruism. Anyone know what altruism is? Altruism is a selfless concern for others. It's being charitable. So Spencer actually argued, you want proof that it's a society, a civilization is highly advanced? Well, if they have the ability to understand the need to be compassionate and empathetic and to give charity, you can't be more highly evolved than that. So on one hand, they're saying use the tools of modernity to help bring the world up. Yes, this means England's going to have to conquer like Africa or India. But English society is so advanced that they will help bring these people up. Sounds great. But like any area of philosophy, there are thinkers on the other side as well. Representing the dark vanguard of social Darwinism is Margaret Sanger. Does anyone know who Margaret Sanger is? Do you know? Margaret Sanger was one of the leading proponents of what is known as eugenics in American academia in the 1910s and 20s and 30s. What's eugenics?
Selective breeding.
She and other American college professors argued for essentially society controlling mating of human beings. The government should mandate that the fit breed with the fit. And government, therefore, should also argue that the unfit, well, they shouldn't really breed at all. Because if the unfit breed, that means you're going to end up with more unfit people. And the goal should be to improve society. FYI, you know who loved her books?
Hitler.
Wow. Yeah, a lot of the leading Nazis in the 1930s read her books. Wow. And they said,
yeah, that's a good idea.
Wow. Was she American? Oh, yeah. By the way, if her name sounds familiar, it could be that she actually helped spearhead a legal institution in our society to further her plans. Have any of you ever heard of Planned Parenthood?
Get out.
Oh, yeah.
Oh my God.
Wow. So in 1919, she wrote a book, and it's available free online. I found it. I found a PDF. You can find it. It was published in 1919 called Birth Control and Racial Betterment. In her book, she argues that the easiest, most compassionate way to decrease the surplus unfit population is through birth control. And she also called for the government using sterilization and segregation to isolate the unfit from the fit. Now, in her book, she does lay out a three-step process for achieving this. And by the way, I am going to quote directly from her book. I don't mean to use these words to be offensive, but I am literally using her words, not mine. Step one. She said the government should look through the entire population and identify those people who are, and I quote, profoundly retarded, the morons, the mental defectives, the epileptics, etc.
In other words, people who have physical disabilities. They should be sterilized. The government should force it. By the way, the Nazis did this with a program called T4. Step number two.
So they would kill them?
Well, they're calling for sterilization.
What does that mean?
That means you can no longer do the nasty. So if it's a woman, she gets her tubes tied. If it's a guy, get a vasectomy. All right, once you get rid of all of the handicapped people, you then go through the rest of the society and you find the people who cannot contribute to the well-being of society. And amongst the people she identified are, and again, not my words, her words, were those who are illiterate. Paupers, poor people, unemployables, criminals, prostitutes, dope fiends. Well, the government should find them all, round them up, and that says confinement, and confine them into rural places. She referred to them as being farms. Human farms. Basically away from good society. But she did also call for extermination of racial inferiors. She said, if you opened up Planned Parenthoods in centers where there are high density populations of these racial inferiors, you then encourage them to get free access to contraceptives and abortions, you can basically reduce the population. So sterilize the people who are handicapped, round up the people who cannot contribute to the society, and kill off the people who are racial inferiors. I've got one more question for you. Who are the racial inferiors she's talking about? Which ones? People of color, black people. In her autobiography, which she published in 1938, she proudly recounts that one of the high, most exciting times of her life occurred in the 1920s when she used to go and give speeches before units of the women's division of the Ku Klux Klan. Ironically, in 1939, Planned Parenthood would actually launch what was called the Negro Project. That was in operation until the 1960s. Because it's no coincidence that most Planned Parenthoods, even today, are in rural areas with high minority populations. And it's also no coincidence that the leading users of Planned Parenthood today are women of color. That's all by strategy.
Why does that still exist?
I know. Crazy, huh?
It's old.
It is. Well, by the way, why doesn't anybody... Well, to answer your question, well, here you go. In 1939, I got all this stuff in my notes. She sent letters to Southern ministers, who were mostly black ministers. And she basically encouraged them not to say anything. Because as she said, and I quote, we do not want word to get out that we want to exterminate the Negro population. If they learn, they will resist. So, if you're going to do social Darwinism, I'm kind of a Spencer guy. Let's help people out. I'm not really into killing everybody just because they look different. But She sold lots of books. She died a millionaire. This movement, social Darwinism, changed the way civilizations looked at one another. And of course, it took place simultaneously in the 19th century. Prior to the 19th century, did the Europeans and the Middle Easterners and the Africans and the Indians and the Chinese, did they recognize the fact that people were different? Yes, they did. But their focus was based on culture. So in other words, no matter what you look like, if you went to, say, Japan, and you learned the language and you learned their culture, you would kind of be accepted. Because you would act essentially Japanese. Or if you went to India, or if you went to Africa, or you went to the Middle East, the same would be true. But beginning in the 19th century, with the development of social Darwinism, based on Darwinism, people started saying, wait. Maybe there's something more than culture. Maybe human beings have actually evolved into different species. And maybe those species have physical characteristics that make some great and some not so great. That make some fit and others not so fit. They looked through history with these weird colored lenses, and they noticed that all of history has been constantly filled with struggles between groups. Tribes, races, nations. But it's very rare that such violent struggles occur within the groups. So for instance, how many times have the Americans fought against one another? Just once. How many times did the French fight against one another? How many times did the English fight against one another? You know, very, very rare, if at all. But going against other groups, it's constant. And some groups win, and some groups lose. Now, why do nations not fight against one another? Well, because they begin arguing, well, because essentially they're the same. They're the same species. But some are better than others. I'm going to start with the Europeans, then I'll give you the Asians, and then I'll give you the Africans to show you what I mean. So Europeans, obviously, are generally speaking Caucasians. But not all Caucasians are the same. In the 19th century, the Brits were one of the most powerful empires on earth. The Germans, they had one of the strongest economies on earth, rapidly industrializing, gaining military strength. And then you go down from there. These were the great nations capable of conquering others. But there are other white people that are not so great, like the Slavs, or the Croats, or I don't know, the Romanians, the Gypsies. Well, they look white, but why don't they have great empires? Well, these species must be superior than those species. Let's go to Asia. as we're going to see, Japan would redefine itself in just three decades, going through what's known as the Meiji Restoration. They went from being primitive under the Tokugawa shogunate to essentially a global power. Well, when the Europeans saw what Japan was doing, they must have sat back and said, whoa, the Japanese, they must be the superior race. Look at what they're able to do. But who are the people getting conquered and subverted in Asia? Well, the Chinese are kind of in the middle at this point, because they were great, but they're getting carved up, so maybe they're not as great as they think they are. But then way down at the bottom, you got people like the Vietnamese, you got the Koreans, and others. These must be the great species, these must be the weak species. Africa. Oh, spelling it wrong. There we go. Look at the Egyptians. By the 19th century, they had a strong economy, maybe not the strongest, but they were stronger than anywhere else. They had control of the Suez Canal. They had all of the pyramids, all of the great things. You had like the Moroccans. You had the Afrikaners. All successful, powerful civilizations. But you also had the people that lived in the Sahara Desert, like the Bedouins. They were primitive. They didn't really have an advanced culture. And then you had like the people down in West Africa, down in the Congo. Again, still running around half naked. They're on the same continent as these people. But look at the way they live. Look at their existence. Inferior, superior. They literally began going around and judging people based on their physical characteristics, what they've accomplished as cultures, and saying some are better than others. And by the way, once they're identified, what can the betters do to the inferiors? Whatever they want. So there's no morality. There's no issues. Now, ironically, it was very rare that they would have studies saying, like, the Brits are better than the Japanese. They didn't do that. But rather, what they said is that the Brits should make an alliance with the Japanese and the Egyptians and control the earth. Why? Well, simple. The successful civilizations, races could prove it. They fought and won wars. They had a modern culture. They had science. They had technology. And the winners of the wars should be able to do what they want with the land they're in. One of the people who argued for this was the late 19th century German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche. Nietzsche, in his book, Thus Spoke Zarathustra, he said that the superiors, Übermensch, upper mensch people, the supermen, if you will, the master race, they, because of their superiority, have all of the rights in the world. And because society should focus on what's best for it, Nietzsche argued that all societies should allow the elites, the supermen, to rule over everything. But he warned the way to destroy the Übermensch is to allow them to breed with the Untermensch. Unter, under. The subhumans. If you do that, you're dead. By the way, if you ever have the ability to listen to any of Adolf Hitler's speeches that you can find on YouTube, you will hear the words Übermensch and Untermensch mentioned frequently. And by the way, it's the same basis of Margaret Sanger's eugenics. So, what did these new racists believe? Well, they had, generally speaking, four beliefs. One, as I said a couple of times, we're not all the same. No, they argued that we are, in fact, all separate species. Like a Dachshund, a German Shepherd, Greyhound. Yeah, they're all dogs, but they're all different breeds. And how can you tell? Well, they said, basically, look at them. They have different skin tones. They have different physical characteristics. And by the way, how do you know people are different? Well, look at the cultures they built. That's kind of like outward proof that they are different. Again, what was going on in the Congo or the Brazilian rainforest, where you had people running around half naked, living lives that was like in the Neolithic period, just above the Stone Age, versus societies that had skyscrapers made out of steel, trains, ironclad vessels, electricity, movies, radio. So what does this mean? Well, very simple. If you know who is the superior and you know who the inferior are, you need to make the inferiors go the way of the dinosaurs. If this is done, you will free up land and resources necessary to support the superior races. Hitler called for what was known as Lebensraum, living space. And one of the reasons why they developed all of the death camps was to basically depopulate Eastern Europe of its populations. Yes, you can pick out some that no one's going to say anything about, like he did definitely go after the Jews. But he also went after the Slavs and the Gypsies and the Romani and the homosexuals, and there was a whole large swath of people that were exterminated. Why? You kill them all and you take their land. And then once you do that, you must make sure there's enough laws and policies in place that the bloodlines of the fit are preserved. So, no interracial marriage. FYI, I don't know how many of you know this, but interracial marriage was actually illegal in states in our country because the United States government never really got involved in marriage until the late 1960s. It was a state issue. And in, I think, six states, as late as 1967, it was illegal for a person of color to marry a person who was on the lighter complexion. And it wasn't until the Supreme Court intervened and declared it to be unconstitutional. But all over the earth, there were laws that said it was illegal for one person of one race to marry another. Even places that had global empires. England, Africa, and so forth. England, France, rather. Why? Out of this belief. We have to maintain our purity. So, you put all this together, you have the intellectual justification and rationale for conquest and exploitation. What does that lead to? A movement known as New Imperialism. The global powers began fanning out and literally trying to carve up every last unclaimed space on Earth. Now, by the 19th century, North America, we had our war for independence. Canada was still part of the English Commonwealth system. Mexico had its revolution. El Salvador, Colombia, all of Central and South America broke away from Europe. But Africa was unclaimed. And as we know, because we talked about it, the Europeans were slowly making inroads into the Asian trade network system. But look at what the British did to get control of India. The same thing the Dutch did to get Indonesia. You go in, you get a footprint, you make relations, you slowly build over time, and eventually you take over. Well, the nations wanted it all, whatever was left. Because when you add in social Darwinism, suddenly it's like, oh my God, if we don't get it, someone else will. And what happens to those empires that don't grow? They die. So, nations who never really were into the idea of colonialism suddenly wanted to go and conquer. And those nations who had been colonial powers wanted to expand. But remember, the whole age of exploration, expansion was not new. But it literally just stopped for about 100 years. During the age of revolution. But beginning in the 1860s and 1870s, England started expanding aggressively to protect what it had. France started trying to gain global colonies because, as we're going to see, they lost a really embarrassing war and they were trying to basically man up again to show that they were possibly strong. Germany was created in 1870, as was Italy, and they wanted to catch up. America, we were doing it. We had the Monroe Doctrine, but we were also, you know, going across the continent. But by the 1870s, we started going into the Pacific, looking at places like Hawaii. Russia was doing the exact opposite. They were going east, all the way into Siberia, and south, down into Persia, and Mongolia, and Manchuria. And Japan, well, we talked about Japan. They industrialized and they suddenly wanted an empire because they're like, well, if that's what it takes to be a great country. So as we're going to see, they would actually go to war with China, kick the living snot out of them, and would take Korea as a protectorate. So these nations started getting aggressive. Why? Well, because if I don't take this seat, you might take that seat. And if you take that seat, you might find something under the ground that will allow you to become stronger and possibly come at me. So I need to take it, even if it looks like desert, because you don't know what's there. But the weird thing is, they made rules on how they were going to do it. So all of the European powers, basically, they built this system that would allow them to control these new places. Because by the 1870s and 80s, the European powers said, you know something? It would be really bad if you and I, we had guys that end up at the place at the same time. Because if your guys are there and my guys are there, what could happen? Yeah, exactly. That could result in a war, and that's not good for business. So let's make some rules. And these rules became known as the degrees of protection. And there were three. So this is what they would apply over the earth. In some places, they actually took full control of the land. They annexed it. And they ruled over the land like colonies. So the mother country sent a governor, sent soldiers, and they controlled it just like they controlled the mother country. That was expensive, though. But there were other places that you would allow the local government to stay in place. And you allow the local government to continue to pretend like it's ruling. But you control who's there. So those will become like puppet states. Both of these involve full national control. You take control over the state that was once there. But what if you're dealing with a place that's really, really big and complex, like China? Well, there are more people in China than there are in all of the world powers combined. So it's not going to be a matter of going in and basically taking over. So if you can't take control of it all, you take little chunks. And these become known as spheres of influence. So you don't take control of the province, you take control of a port. You don't take control of a province, maybe you take control of an island. Well, you negotiate with the government, and basically that part becomes essentially yours. So the example that I want to get in your heads is what the British did to Hong Kong. They took the island, had control of it for over 100 years, and ironically, Hong Kong, before they gave it back to the Chinese, would be one of the capitalistic centers of Asia. But that little sphere would be governed like a colony. So you'd have people from the mother country that would go and run the little details of the state. But again, it was limited in geographic scope. A port, an island, something along those lines. Not a whole country. So that would be like if Canada came down and took control of Boston. They might not take control of the city, but they'd take control of Boston Harbor.
What happened to Taiwan?
Taiwan was controlled by the Japanese, and then the Japanese had to turn it over to the Chinese, and then the Chai Coms rose up under Mao Zedong and drove the nationalists, the Kuomintang, out, and so the Chinese nationalists would take control of Taiwan. So both technically call themselves China, but one is the nationalist Chinese, the other one's the communist Chinese. I know weird things.
Yeah, they're good things.
Oh, yeah. I do well on Jeopardy, depending upon the category. All right. So before we start doing examples, we'll do that on Thursday. We're going to make it real simple. And we're going to tell you why they did it. Why did they play this game? Well, to bring it full circle, these nations were industrializing. They needed resources. Because the more resources they get, the more goods they could produce.
Sorry.
And the more goods that they could produce, the more workers could be employed. The more taxes could be raised. So ultimately, you needed to fuel the beast. But by taking possession of these lands, they also served as markets. So if you take control of someone else's country, you can basically tell them you can only get your stuff from us. So you have built-in customers. And you also have a place for investment. You know, if I got $1 billion sitting in my bank account, do I want to invest that $1 billion into like a railroad in the Ukraine right now? No, but maybe I'll invest it in Puerto Rico, which is an American territory. You also had the emergence of nationalism. People by the 19th century stopped identifying themselves based on the town in which they were born, or even the state in which they were born, and instead started looking as the nation as a whole. So in this game of winners and losers, obviously they wanted their country to win. Because if their country wins, it increases opportunity for the people within the country. Because as the old saying goes, when the tide comes in, all boats rise. So if your country could beat out the French or beat out the Germans and take that, there's going to be a greater chance of you being successful, being a millionaire. Wow. And last but not least, social Darwinism. Some nations were motivated by altruism. Some nations were motivated by genocidal intentions. I mean, wait till we see what the Belgians did to the Congo. I mean, there was some crazy stuff that happened during this time. But ultimately, it was inherent in the belief that they had a right to do it because they were better. They were a better species. They were a better culture. They had a better economy. They had a better military. And as history's shown, those who have the power can pretty much do whatever they want, whenever they want, to whomever they want. Questions? All right, before I let you go, I'm going to repeat to those people who came late what I said to those people who were here on time. So you took your exam this weekend, and I needed to submit my grades for midterms. You took the exams, most of you. A couple of you did not take the exam. So if you did not take the exam, what I had to do is I had to take your average of the first exam and average it with a zero, which basically means you probably got an F. Now, if you did not take the exam, I will let you take a makeup, but you have to basically send me an email, and I will program it in and you can take it. That's situation number one. Situation number two, and I forget the exact count, but seven of you, I caught cheating. Because I took your essays and I plugged them into an AI detector. Now, that is a violation of the school's academic code of honesty. And by right, I could give you a zero and I could report you to the dean. But I'm not that kind of guy. Because at the end of the day, exam two only counts as 15% of your final average. So what I decided to do is I gave you a 60. So if you were one of the people on exam two that got a 60, I caught you. I will allow you to take a makeup if you claim that you did not actually cheat. But it's going to be a paper copy. You're going to do a physical exam. And you can prove to me that you actually know the stuff. If, however, you are one of the people that got a 60, and you acknowledge, you don't have to tell me I don't need a big scene, we're just going to move forward. This means I'm basically giving you a chance to pass the class. Could have gave you a zero, which would have meant you got an F. But I'm doing this as a warning, because I believe in retribution. Not retribution, that sounds real, man. Rehabilitation. We learn from our mistakes. So, when exam number three comes around, if I see anybody that finishes the exam in 15 minutes, gets all the multiple choice questions right, and AI picks up their essay, I'm going to give you a zero and I'm going to report you to the dean. Because I gave you a chance and you went against me. Learn from this. Don't repeat. All right? See you on Thursday.